Not gonna work? 3:53?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No work session on 3:53 yet. All right, public hearing, 2344. Where's my list? Wait a second, hang on a second, let's not do that one. We've got Vicki Walker. Vicki, you're here on which one again?
Cheryl Walker.
Cheryl Walker.
Mm-hmm.
He just swore I edited it. Vicki, forgive me if you heard that. Okay, 2353.
Public hearing.
Take it easy, don't go fast, just be calm.
All right.
Okay?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. I appreciate your concern.
Arsenio, you look like the sole presenter on this.
Well, that was, I didn't understand that I was going to be, excuse me, I'm tearing up your equipment. Thank you, Chair Minnis and Committee. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak this afternoon on House Bill 2353. Colleagues, I ask you to join me in support of this bill today, and I believe there are two very important reasons to support it. The first one is rather obvious, we need to punish people who use sedative drugs to take advantage of women. Our laws need to be updated to take into consideration this new and dangerous form of abuse, and it is an abuse. The second reason is not as obvious, but is just as important. By passing this legislation, we can elevate the importance of this issue and bring it to the attention of our local communities, law enforcement agencies, and citizens. Many people in smaller communities think these kinds of crimes are exclusive to the big city or to college campuses, but they are not. They reach into every corner of our state, and they affect every age group of women, from the very young to the older. Women in small communities are just as vulnerable as those in large metropolitan areas. No place in Oregon is safe from the threat of this drug, or of these drugs as a group. By taking this action today to pass it out of your committee, we will make the use of date rape drugs a crime in Oregon, as it should be, and we will use our position as elected officials to publicize this growing problem. Please join me in support House Bill 2353. And I apologize, Chair Minnis, I don't think I stated my name. I'm Representative Cheryl Walker from House District 51.
Thank you very much. And Representative, did you work on this in your subcommittee in the House, or?
This actually came out of the Judiciary Committee, on which I do sit, but I am chair of the Civil Subcommittee, so it went through the Criminal Committee and then to the full.
All right.
But I did support it on the House floor.
All right.
As well.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Burdick.
Chairman, thank you. Is this bill written broadly enough, in your opinion, to cover these people who go to these rave dances and just basically distribute drugs? They don't necessarily know where they're going to, as I understand it, but there was a young woman who died at one of these raves in Portland. And I'm just wondering if this bill would help to address that issue.
Chair Minnis and Senator Burdick, this bill was meant to be one that would apply to those individuals that administer drugs knowingly to an individual who does not know that they are receiving that drug. In other words, the victim has no knowledge of what has occurred, and the perpetrator has taken the intentional act of putting it in the drink or food or whatever to actually slip it to this person without their knowledge.
So to follow up, so in a case like this, if there was, say, and I don't know exactly how the drugs get out at these raves, but if it was presented as a bowl of candy or something that people just took thinking it was something else,
mm-hmm.
Do you think that would this would cover it?
I believe it would. Excuse me, Chair Minnis, Representative Burdick, I believe it would.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Metzger.
Yes, thank you, Representative Walker. My understanding is going through the material in the file is that part of this intent is to more closely align this penalty with what is already incurred on a federal level, other than the fact that a lot of these cases are actually prosecuted under state laws rather than federal laws, but that we have similarly tough legislation that would deal with federal court prosecution of these types of cases. Is that correct?
Chairman Ennis and Senator Metzger, I'm not familiar with the federal statutes, and I don't really know how they would work together.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Maybe the council might answer that, because I know in the things material that there is a federal law also, but that this may help in terms of state prosecutions.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Mark McDonald's here from the Multnomah County DA's office, and I think he can probably address that issue. And also, if you read the bill, you'll notice that it also deals with what's called a controlled substance analog, which I hope Mr. McDonald can explain what that term means, too, not to put you on the spot.
Members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney for Multnomah County. I run the drug unit. I'm not really sure what the federal law is, but no disrespect intended for the U.S. Attorney's Office. They have extremely high threshold levels before they prosecute cases. So what really happens in the federal court is really of not great importance to the local level. The burden of prosecuting these cases fall on local district attorney's offices. This would certainly help in that regard. It'd be recognition of a very serious problem. While we don't see a large number of cases, we do see them across the state.
Okay. All right.
Oh, there was a question about the analog. That addresses specifically the problem with ecstasy. There are several drugs that fall sort of under the heading of ecstasy. There's MDMA, and then there's MDA, which have similar characteristics, but they're not exactly the same.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. In the absence of this law, is there anything you can do to move against people? I mean, how is it prosecuted now?
Well, the person can be charged with delivery of a controlled substance, but under sentencing guidelines, it's at a very low level. One of the enhancers that would raise it from a level 4 to a level 6 if it was for consideration. But obviously, if the person's not aware that it's being put in their drink or given to them surreptitiously, there's no consideration there.
Mr. Chairman, it falls, so you can't get them in for assault or anything like that under existing law, or is that just too hard?
Well, you might be able to get them for assault, but then again, you may not have there'd be a question about what degree of injury would be, what level that type of offense would be. This deals with it very straightforwardly.
But
thank you,
Mark. You probably agree trying to prosecute them under some theory of assault might be a little bit ethereal and difficult to.
It would be difficult.
Jury to
and the problem with doing that is a lot of times the jury they have a hard time understanding that theory and frequently will become confused. This makes it very clear and straightforward.
All right. Well, we do happen to have a gentleman from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Tom, you want to come from?
I'm glad I didn't say anything disrespectful.
As it so happens, you avoided offending the U.S. Attorney.
Excuse me. Excuse me, Chairman. Do you have any further questions?
We don't have any further questions for you, Representative, if you want to release.
Well, I have another hearing that I need to go to, so I appreciate your attention today, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Tom Leininger. I've met some of you when I testified before the Interim Judiciary Committee in support of this bill, I recall, Senator Duncan and Senator Courtney. We have, over the last year, solicited input from various groups and recently received some very helpful input from the Multnomah County DA's office. And with your indulgence, I'd like to present briefly the theory of this bill. But perhaps at the outset, I'd like to address Senator Burdick's question about why it would be difficult to prosecute such an act under current assault laws. I think the explanation given by this gentleman was excellent. One additional concern raised by the group of officers and victims advocates that we've worked with is in order to prove any type of assault, including assault four, there would need to be the intent to cause bodily harm. And one of the classes of acts we're trying to reach with this legislation is even where a person drugs another person's drink, intending to make that person happy, we want to make sure that that is included within the scope of this bill. There was a question about controlled substance analogs. When I first wrote this draft, I did not include analog language. And the domestic violence advocate community was very concerned that this bill be more flexible than the federal listing of controlled substances, which we adopt in Oregon. Part of the problem is that some of the date rape drugs, such as GHB and ketamine, were listed long after they became a problem. Ketamine was only listed in August of 1999, GHB in the spring of 2000, after I think about 100 people had died from being given GHB without their knowledge. What the analog language does, it borrows from federal law a terminology that includes functional equivalents of controlled substances. If you recall, it was big news in Portland when Tom Gugliotta, the NBA player, took an analog of GHB and nearly died. That analog is not now federally listed. It's GBL. But because it's functionally equivalent to GHB, it would be covered by the analog language. This enables us to borrow from federal law some of the case law governing what is an analog, just the same way that we borrow from federal law the definition of a controlled substance. With that, I might just very quickly lay out, I've prepared testimony similar to what I submitted in the House hearings, and I'll leave this with you. Sorry, I was stuck in court today. There are three points I wanted to cover at the outset. The first is the nature of the problem that this bill would address, the problem of drug-induced date rape. Second issue is the inadequacy of current Oregon law. I'm a member of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and our commission studied thoroughly whether current Oregon law was adequate and compared it to the law of other states and concluded that there was a gap we need to address. And then third, what the bill as it now stands would accomplish. And I hope that the amendments offered by the Multnomah County DA's office representatives will be seriously considered. I think they strengthen our proposal. On the subject of the current problem of drug-induced date rape, there's another witness here today that I hope we'll have a chance to hear from. Claudia Weber from the Oregon Legislative Alliance could give a good perspective from the victims advocates community. I would say simply there are three drugs that are now classified throughout the nation as date rape drugs. These include flunitrazepam, which is a sedative that cannot be sold in the United States. It's 10 times more powerful than Valium. It's a drug that can easily be smuggled into the United States and is used to commit date rape. It's also known as roofies. I believe in Central Oregon there are documented cases of date rape with this drug. GHB is a rave drug similar to MDMA, ecstasy. It's one that's become increasingly popular, very simple to make in one's own home with two precursors in an endothermic reaction. The instructions are posted on the internet. It only requires GBL and Red Devil Lye. The third is ketamine, which is a veterinary anesthetic. It can be stolen from vets' offices. These three drugs share the properties that they're colorless, they're odorless, they are easy to conceal in someone's drink, they are powerful sedatives, and so they're ideal drugs to use to commit date rape. The incidence of date rape is difficult to document. I know from speaking with people in various DA's offices, there are examples of drug-induced date rape that are hard to reach under current law. We heard testimony on the House side from Marion County advocates who had victims in this community. There are victims in the Portland community and some in Central Oregon that we know of, as a matter of fact. I'd encourage the committee to hear from Claudia Weber today because she has a much better perspective than I. These drugs have been seen in Oregon. The second point is whether we can address the problem under current law. That's been explored to some extent. I would say simply we have three hooks to hang a drug case on now under Oregon law: delivery, manufacture, and possession. The question is, does the act of drugging a woman's drink in a bar or slipping drugs into her food fall clearly under one of those three categories. I guess the closest category would be delivery. However, very few of these cases are presently prosecuted under the delivery statute. I think when you look at the definition in the ORS under 475, you have the same reaction that a juror would, and that is that delivery implies providing something to the knowing possession of the recipient. There's federal case law in the context of revoking parole that when you possess a drug in your bloodstream, that doesn't count as possession. When a parolee or a person on supervised release is giving a dirty UA, a urine sample, and the prosecution, I want to argue that that person necessarily possessed a drug. The Ninth Circuit has held that possession is different from having a drug in your blood. So I would be concerned, and evidently prosecutors are concerned. I know the ODAA and Dale Penn have endorsed this bill because delivery does not clearly encompass the conduct we're trying to prohibit. Other states have passed laws that include the act of causing another person to ingest a controlled substance without that person's knowledge. And I would share the perspective of the prior speaker that that just makes clear for the jury that this is not allowed. If you also consider the publicity surrounding this bill, it will help to send a signal to people who are engaged in a rational cost-benefit analysis. People who commit date rape with drugs are thinking about costs and benefits. They're planning a strategy. And I believe that the education campaigns on college campuses and the publicity surrounding passage of this bill will help with that cost-benefit calculus in a way that you don't often see in criminal law. This is a group that is susceptible to deterrence, and I think that spelling out clearly what's illegal will help with deterrence. Ma'am? Senator Burdick?
I'll wait till you're done.
Oh.
Will you finish?
I was going to summarize quickly, finally.
Summarize, and Senator Burdick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The provisions of the bill are fairly straightforward. I've spoken with John Horton at the Marion County DA's office and would welcome, from my standpoint, these changes that would strengthen the classification of the offenses under the sentencing guidelines from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. There are a couple safety valves in this bill I wanted to highlight. On the House side, there was some concern expressed about the involuntary ingestion of marijuana smoke, which may happen at a party. That's specifically exempted here. Some people from the industry who want to use GHB to treat narcolepsy wanted to be clear in the bill that this bill won't reach the use of such drugs pursuant to a doctor's care. And that's been accomplished in this bill by referencing the definition of administration and dispensing of controlled substances. A doctor's prescription of these medicines or someone providing them pursuant to a doctor's orders won't fall under this bill. I guess with that, I might just respond to Senator Burdick's questions and any others.
Senator Burdick?
Chairman, I'd like to ask you two the same question I asked Representative Walker, and that is this written broadly enough to cover a rave situation where somebody doesn't target one particular person, but maybe distributes candy, things that people think are candy or could think are candy, and just distribute it without necessarily directing it toward one person?
Senator Burdick, I guess it depends on the facts and the knowledge of the person who took the drug. If they were not aware that this was ecstasy or some other drug and they thought it was just candy, I think it would apply. But if a person, you know, was aware or had a good idea that what they were taking was ecstasy, it would not apply. Generally speaking, that's not what happens in these raves. There's people are going around, we call them hooks, asking who wants any ecstasy. They find people that are interested and take them back to the person that's the supplier. The people are pretty open in these raves. The ecstasy is pills. A lot of times they wear the pills and a necklace around their neck. They come in all shapes and colors. And they do include many drugs other than MDMA, other similar type drugs.
So you haven't found it. I guess now you know the truth that I don't go to these things. So you haven't found it at these things that were people are giving them to people unknowingly.
That has not been the evidence that we've seen. It certainly could be the situation. I think most of the people that go to these things understand what's being handed out. It's pretty open. But, I mean, there might be some individuals who go there and take something unwittingly. We haven't seen any of those cases yet.
Thank you.
All right, and kind of to the same point, is consent the same as knowledge?
I think knowledge is required for consent. So I think...
Well, let me give you the example. Somebody, sure. I think Representative Burdick used this example. I don't know how realistic it would be. But you have a bowl of candy that's laced with a drug.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody picks one up, eats it, they've consented it. I mean, they obviously picked it up and ingested it, but they did not know it was laced with a drug. Is that the same thing?
I would, in that circumstance, argue with the prosecutor that there was not a consent to the ingestion of the controlled substance, while there might be to the ingestion of the candy. I'm sure you know from your law enforcement experience where there's a close enough case that maybe the application of the statute might not be a good fit. I would be confident that the officers and the prosecutors might sort some of those out. If there's an accidental, for example, if you drug candy for three people to consume knowingly and a fourth person arrives without your knowledge, Deputy John Horton felt comfortable in Multnomah County that such cases would be filtered out if that's a concern of the committee. But I do think that if you set such bait out intending to cause someone to take the drug, that would be fair game for prosecution.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Counsel.
Tom, I wanted to ask you a question kind of just to establish a record, I suppose. But the term controlled substance analog, have you considered whether that is acceptable under a vagueness test? I mean, in the federal, I'm unaware of how that term is used or how it's been interpreted in the federal system.
I'm not aware of a published case that addresses that. However, it's been on the books for nearly a year and three quarters now and has not been challenged. I think there's not an easy way, Mr. Prince, to address the concern of functional equivalence. However, in this field with designer drugs where the molecular structure can be manipulated so easily to circumvent the current listing, and with the FDA acting so slowly to list drugs, I think it's worth a try. And there's some crafty defense attorneys throughout the country in the federal system, and if they haven't tripped it up in the last 18 months, I feel confident that it would stand in Oregon as well.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We do have Claudia Weber to come up.
Thank you.
You bet. Ms. Weber.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Claudia Weber. I am on the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force, as well as a member of the Oregon Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women. I have also worked in the field of sexual assault advocacy for over 4 years with the Rape Crisis Center in Washington County. I can tell you that the cases that I have worked with and what I have seen regarding predatory drugs is not only frightening, but it's sickening. Senator Burdick, your question about the candy is so apropos. I worked with on a case where I had two female survivors, and we do call them survivors in the advocacy world. One was 17, and a very small girl, about 5'2" and 125 pounds. The other was 19, and she was about 5'11" and 225 pounds. They had been out partying all night, but had not had 1 ounce of alcohol. They went to a final party about 2 o'clock in the morning and were very tired and asked somebody to take them home. And the people at the party, two specific young men, said, you know, I have some caffeine pills, and if you want to just pop a couple of these, it'll help you stay awake. all it is caffeine. You can buy it in a drugstore. These two young women took those pills. Both of them were then passed out and have no recollection until they were almost in battleground Washington and starting to get flashbacks of what happened to them. That's when they came back down to Washington County, and I accompanied both of them to the emergency room where sexual assault kits were performed. Both came back with positive for semen. Both came back negative for any alcohol in their bodies. These two young women are still getting flashbacks from GHB. They are still wondering what specifically happened to them, other than somebody obviously penetrated them and ejaculated inside of them without their permission. Other than that, they have no recollection. We see this over and over again. Finding GHB or Rohypnol in somebody's urine is very difficult. And one of the reasons is because GHB dissipates within 12 to 18 hours. And so if a sexual assault survivor does not go to an emergency room and seek medical attention almost immediately after a sexual assault, which is not the norm in a sexual assault case, to be able to have a urine sample taken by law enforcement, have that sample processed properly into evidence, which means it needs to be refrigerated or frozen immediately, because then the drug will dissipate if it's not, and if it stays at room temperature too long, those drugs can't be found in the urine. And it's unlikely that it's going to be found in blood. And blood is not part of a normal rape exam. And neither is urine, by the way. So a law enforcement officer needs to be aware of the red flags when they hear a rape survivor's re-encountment of what happened to them. Over 84% of sexual assaults are what we call acquaintance rapes. It's somebody that they know. It's somebody in their family. It's somebody that they met at a party or a bar and said, yes, we'll go play pool or play cards or have another drink. What we all hear about in the newspapers are the stranger rapes, and those are very few and far between. Those are really not going to be a drug-induced sexual assault. It's the over 84%. And most of these women and men, by the way, who are involved in acquaintance rapes, don't want to report. They're afraid of reporting. They don't want to get a trusted friend into trouble. I'm a survivor of sexual assault. I was not a survivor of a drug-induced sexual assault, thank God. But mine happened many, many years ago in a different state. My perpetrator was a family friend. I had known him since I was 5 years old. I was 22 when he raped me. He was also our family attorney. I never told anybody. To this day, my mother doesn't know, and my father went to his grave 5 years ago not knowing. And I still will not tell my family. And I'm just happy they're in another state and can't hear this testimony. But that's how acquaintance rapes are. People don't want to get their friends and people that they've trusted into trouble, whether it's a drug-induced sexual assault or not. When we're in the emergency room as advocates with survivors of sexual assault, we hear over and over again, I didn't drink, I only had one drink, and I don't remember. I woke up with no underwear on. I woke up feeling sticky. I woke up someplace I don't remember, and I don't remember where I was when I started out. That's a drug-induced sexual assault. That's Rohypnol. That's gamma-hydroxybutrate, which is GHB. Gamma-hydroxybutrate, excuse me. That's possibly ketamine. GHB has floor stripper in it and lye. People make it in powder form. It comes in a little vial, half an inch maybe. It costs about a dollar. It can be sprinkled on a McDonald's hamburger or on a steak at Morton Steakhouse. It comes in a little vial in liquid form. It can be put in root beer or any other alcoholic drink. Rohypnol is manufactured legally outside of this country and comes in a little white tablet that has the name of Hoffman LaRoche on that tablet. Someone gave that to an unsuspecting, uneducated person, they would think it was a legal drug. That drug, all of these drugs, induce coma, reduce pulmonary function, reduce cardiac function, and GHB will kill you in the proverbial New York minute. People who administer these drugs without somebody's knowledge are predators. They need to be stopped. They need to be put away, and they need much stricter sentencing. Oregon is one of the only states that does not have a law that protects people from the deliverance of these drugs with the intent to commit a violent crime or under any other circumstances. And I urge you, please, to pass this bill to protect not only young people out there, but people in rural areas. I'm from Washington County, and I can tell you that it happens in Gaston, in Banks, in North Plains, as well as in Beaverton and Hillsborough. We take calls at the Rape Crisis Center from all over the Tri-County area, and it doesn't make any difference what the economic stature is of our survivors. They're still given these drugs without their knowledge, and they're still devastating and deadly.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Weber.
Thank you.
Work session, House Bill 2353. There are amendments that have been offered, and I don't want a motion to accept them. And the reason is that they deal with the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. We have in our possession Senate Bill 472, which is the bill that requires the approval of the work of the commission during the interim and the rules of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. It would be my intent to bring these amendments to Senate Bill 472 and include those as a collaborative bill dealing with the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, as opposed to amending them into this bill that might cause a tweak in the fiscal analysis that might doom it to an untimely death in ways and means.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2353A and goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2353 engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Metzger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, Chair, or maybe Council. I realize, as per your group direction, not doing the amendment, but I was curious about the amendment, looking over Tom's testimony, that the bill that we have was a collaboration with prosecutors, law enforcement officers, et cetera. And, you know, they passed it without those amendments. The amendments are increased penalties, and I'm we'll be dealing with them later. I'm just curious as to we're going from the C to the B felony on the one, and the categories 8 and 9. And I just, for my own information, is kind of what has happened since the House and the reason for that, so that when we make this relation later in the session, I'll understand why. Sure. Something has changed since the House passed.
Mark, do you feel like speaking to that? Or,
Chairman and Senator Metzger, again, Mark McDonald from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I don't have a complete explanation for that because I'm pitch hitting for Mr. Horton from my office today, but it was talking to him, it would be a recognition of the seriousness of this particular offense. We didn't want to make it a lower felony than might delivery might otherwise be. Also, we wanted to recognize that delivery of controlled substance without consent is a very serious offense and should have a commensurate penalty, and then with the intent to commit a violent act should be also recognized with a commensurate penalty. I was not involved in the discussion process, so I really can't tell you any more than that.
Okay. Well, we can address that when we do it later then. Sure. I was curious as to what.
The one thing the committee just throw out as a suggestion without would not cause a fiscal impact would be to classify simply the delivery without consent as a B felony, and the with the intent to commit a violent felony as an A felony. That doesn't have any fiscal impact, but it's a recognition of the seriousness of the particular crimes.
Well, Mr. McDonald, I don't know that that doesn't have a fiscal impact.
Okay.
My assumption would be that the B felony would potentially cause a longer prison sentence, and Phil Lemon's not here to tell me otherwise.
Okay.
So I would like to proceed. Again.
Sure.
Rather than getting surprised on the Senate floor. All right, motion. Move the board floor. Move the bill to the floor of the Senate for the discussion. Any objections? Hearing none. Anyone want to carry this bill? Senator Courtney. Senator Courtney will carry House Bill 353. Are we ready on 353?
Yes.
Work session. Senate Bill
353. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 353 is the bill that Connie Gallagher spoke to us about earlier this week. It's the bill regarding if you'll recall, when a victim of a criminal act is killed, and there should be two amendments before you, excuse me, to finish that sentence. When a victim is killed, Department of Justice has a section which deals with paying compensation to crime victims. And part of the calculation that they do is in determining the amounts they consider and determine the extent to which the victim's acts or conduct provoked or contributed to injuries. Senator Menace, in our conversations, I'll ask you first to look at the Dash 1 amendments. If you look at the Dash 1 amendments, what this would do is, as Senator Menace had pointed out, in line 13 of the bill, we would be changing the language from shall to may. As you know, that's just making it a discretionary on part of the Department of Justice on whether or not they reduce the award or compensation. When I looked at this bill after the session, I also looked at another section of 147, which deals with these crime victim payments. And it says in ORS 147015, which I'll just read to you, that a person is eligible if the death or injury to the victim was not substantially attributable to the wrongful act of the victim or substantial provocation of the assailant of the victim. I put in the Dash 2 amendments another amendment, which would be to delete the words provoked or in line 12. And the reason I would do that is because the other statute I just mentioned already says that a person is not eligible if they if there was substantial provocation on behalf of the victim, and I thought that this would clarify that we're not having two different standards, because if the finding is that there was substantial provocation, they're not eligible, period. The victim is not eligible at all. So I didn't want to make it in this language to make it confusing for any practitioners or jury or judges, the issue of we're not saying if a person did provoke it, DOJ may still give the award. So that's why I put that amendment there. I spoke with Ms. Gallagher, and I think she would agree with the Dash 2 amendments being the one we would have before the committee.
Okay.
You don't want the Dash 1?
Dash 2, actually.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 353.
Okay. Senator Courtney moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 353. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 353 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 353 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation as amended by the committee. Discussion? Any objection? Chair, is in order. Senator Parker, would you like to carry this?
He's fired up. He's
let you all fired up and ready to go. Senator Parker will carry this.
Now, Parker, what is happening? Parker?
See. Public hearing. 2385, creating the crime of interference with agricultural research. Shadowy coming? I don't know.
Who is it? Do they want me? What are they after me?
I think also for the committee, because we're going to be transitioning to hearing a lot of House bills pretty soon, one of the directions that I've given to the committee staff is that I want to try to minimize, you know, duplication of hearings that occurred in the House, if possible. So what I want to do is make sure that you all get copies of the staff measure summaries of the bills that are posted. So if you look at them, if you have an interest in having longer hearings or more prolonged hearings, or you have specific opposition to a bill that you're aware of, if you could help me know that so that we can kind of accommodate that. Because what I'd like to do is try to move those bills through as quickly as I can without duplicating a lot of testimony and such on and so forth. So I'll also be asking the staff to, some of the bills were a little bit more complex, kind of give us a briefing of what the hearings were in the House, how they rationalized and went through processes, coming to decisions, and then go about hearing it, hopefully moving them. All right. Counsel, you want to tell us about this puppy?
Actually, this is the bill, this is a bill that deals with interference with agricultural research. It's a bill, as my understanding, there was quite a bit of discussion about looking at making sure we exempt the proper people, basically. I think it comes out of some of the incidents of eco-terrorism that have occurred in the state. And we have, I think, representatives from the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Chatfield?
Yes.
Do you want to bring any other persons with you, or are you by yourself?
I'm by myself.
Okay.
Actually, I had signed up.
For the record, my name is Byron Chatfield. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Attorney General's office. I am with the Criminal Justice Division in charge of the organized crime section. I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General to support House Bill 2385. There is also another House Bill 2344 that we're also supportive of, which also adds particular crimes to the racketeering statute, RICO. Eco-terrorism is becoming a significant and major criminal issue here in the Northwest. And we believe that racketeering accurately reflects the criminal conduct engaged in by these particular groups. They present, or this racketeering presents a clearer picture of the criminal activities that these groups are involved in, distinguishing between conventional crimes where you focus on a single criminal incident as opposed to RICO or racketeering, where you're looking at a series of events of criminal activity over a period of time. This bill would also, by adding it to RICO, would allow a more severe sanction for organized criminal conduct and the accountability for that type of conduct. It's our intent that for the committee to look at that and to consider the this particular bill, and we certainly do support that. I know that there's other people here that are much more familiar with the aspects of the damage and what has been involved in the industry and how they've been harmed by this type of activity, and they would certainly be in a better position to address that probably than I would.
All right, and I see that we are privileged to have Representative Shetterly here, who chaired, I think, the Interim Judiciary Committee. It's a product of their work also. So, Representative, you'll come up and help enlighten us. Yes. If you would like, I assume you're here on 2344
yeah.
also. If you
Thanks.
Speak to both of them if you want.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will be brief because I think you'll probably have more compelling testimony from the other witnesses. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 34. If I may start with 2344, may I comment on that first? That was the bill that got this started, and that amends Oregon's RICO statute, racketeering influence corrupt organizations, to include three crimes that are on there, tree spiking, interference with animal research, and interference with livestock production. The point of this being that House Bill 23, or that the Oregon RICO statutes are modeled on the federal RICO statutes, and those are the statutes that the FBI used several years ago to, as an effective tool against the organized crime. And as we are seeing developing nationally, the manner in which the fringe elements of the environmental organizations operate is very much like organized crime 30 years ago, in small cells, anonymously, even to themselves. And it can be difficult to prosecute directly in some cases. By adding these discrete crimes to the RICO statutes, we're creating an opportunity here to use lower-level criminal activity, I say C felony and misdemeanor criminal activity, to get at some what is really a very serious effort to undermine Oregon's economy and legitimate and legal agricultural and timber practices, so that groups that participate in actions that may by themselves seem to be insignificant, an isolated incident of tree spiking or a criminal mischief event here or some damage to property there, if those are shown to be part of a criminal enterprise with a common objective, then those low-level crimes can be prosecuted as a RICO offense and elevated to a Class A felony. And I see that as serving two purposes. One is punishment, obviously. If you've got people who are engaged in this pattern and practice of criminal activity for a common objective, what we call a pattern of racketeering activity in the statute, we want to treat them as serious offenses. And as we have seen, they can be very serious offenses. And so this will give law enforcement, I think, a tool to deal with these organizations that act through cells and individuals and groups to begin to prosecute them at the level that they need to be prosecuted. What we did with House Bill 2385 was create a new crime, and that is interfering with agricultural research. And then we add that to the list of RICO statutes, too. That's, frankly, just kind of a gap in the statutes that we don't have right now. It fits very well with the statutes that we are adding to RICO in House Bill 2344. And so what we're doing then is we're taking these elements of tree spiking, interference with animal research, interference with livestock production, and interference with agricultural research, and we're saying if you're going to do these, and if you're going to do them as a part of a pattern and practice of activities under a common enterprise, then we are going to treat them as a very serious offense. And I really do think this elevates the seriousness of environmental sabotage and gives the state and prosecutors the ability to deal with it as a serious offense as it is. These bills got outstanding support in the House, and there will be one more coming to you. We just passed it on the House floor this morning, and that was amending a couple of the statutes that are in House Bill 2344, interference with animal research and interference with livestock production, to tighten those and make those more narrowly focused. And together, I think we will have a very well-constructed series of statutes here that will say, number one, we are taking a dim view on environmental sabotage, and number two, we'll give the police and prosecutors the ability to deal with them and treat offenders seriously in the event somebody nevertheless commits any of these crimes.
Questions? No questions.
Thank you very much.
What a sterling job.
I will leave with your committee staff just to show you that this is not, this is still current in the news. This is an article from the Corvallis Gazette-Times. Wednesday, March 28th, there was just an event even between the time this bill passed in the House and got down here to the Senate, an event in Corvallis, Oregon State, and also near Klamath Falls, where activists destroyed about 800 trees at research plots in Corvallis, determining that those offend their sensibility and morality, and so they're just going to take it upon themselves to destroy these research plots, and that's the kind of stuff that these bills will get at.
Senator Harper.
Well, why don't you bring it up, Wayne? What What happened to those people under this bill specifically?
Well, first of all, those individual events themselves, the destruction of the trees, are criminal. What would happen under this bill is if you have an event like that, two or more of those events that occur within a 5-year time period, then if one of those events might only be a Class A misdemeanor, or both of those events might only be a Class A misdemeanor, it's going to elevate those and give the prosecutors ability to prosecute them as Class A felonies, which, again, is going to get somebody's attention, we hope, when they're recruited to maybe engage in some of these discrete criminal acts. And if it doesn't get their attention and serve as deterrent, then it will provide a criminal penalty that I think is more commensurate with the real activity that's going on here, which is greater than just a few hundred dollars worth of damage here and a few hundred dollars worth of damage there.
Class A felony, not the death penalty.
Pardon? When you move these into RICO, it becomes a Class A felony, you bet. Serious stuff.
He was wanting death penalty.
Oh, not death penalty. Well, of course, there's all you can amend this anyway.
Subject of an interim study.
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
But I do. I thank you for taking this up, and we will be sending over on the way the other bill that amends the two of the statutes that are in House Bill 2344. But with that, I think we'll have a very tight package of bills this session to say that Oregon takes a dim view and looks very seriously on acts of environmental sabotage within our state.
All right. Thank
All
you,
right.
Representative.
Thank you.
For your time. All right, Terry Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rest assured, the information that's being passed out is I am not going to cover it all. I will try to keep my testimony very brief. Chair Minnis and members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I will just summarize the testimony that we gave on the House side, and I think Representative Shetterly characterized the problem fairly accurately. Eco-terrorism or eco-warrior activities, as many people call them, are significantly on the rise. I think some of the last statistics show that since 1980, for example, there have been more than 100 major acts of eco-destruction in the western states, and they define major as at least $50,000 in damage to a total of almost $43 million. One of the most disturbing things is that of those 100 incidents, 33 of them were in the last 4 years alone, and one out of every five attack occurred in the state of Oregon. So the Oregon is a prime target for these types of activities. These activities are not expressions of free speech. They are not protests. They are criminal acts that result in property destruction, and fortunately to date have not resulted in any loss of life. But that, I think, is only a matter of time if we don't take bold steps. I will not go through all of my testimony. I would just like to say that Oregon is not alone in its recognition of this as a major problem. Last year, in the 2000 legislature, the state of California passed the first Eco-Terrorism Act, very similar to what we are proposing here in Oregon. This year, there are 28 other states, including Oregon, that are looking at statutes of this nature, 9 of which have already passed. So this is a recognized growing problem across the country. What I would just like to point to your attention to is on the goldenrod sheet. These two attachments, the green newspaper from the called The Resistance, and the goldenrod sheet, which is called the Nighttime Gardener, which comes off of the Internet. These two sheets are by eco-terrorists. And so I think they probably represent the most compelling reason why we need to take this crime seriously. If you look through these sheets, and particularly the goldenrod ones, the areas that I have highlighted, you will see that their aim is to destroy property and specifically to destroy research, because they believe that to destroy research is to destroy the future of many of these activities, particularly in the area of genetic research. These are not demonstrations of free speech. It's particularly scary because when I look at this, what they are doing is soliciting warriors from around the country on the web and giving them what they believe are the tools to go out and do their dirty work. The very first sentence says, "The following guide was put together for the WTO gathering in hopes that people from all over the continent would find this information useful and inspiring." That's a telling tale that they're trying to basically inspire folks to go out and become criminals, eco-warriors, as they call them. I will close my testimony by just saying that we very carefully amended both House Bill 2385 and 2344 to be very considerate and concerned about entrapping those people who are out just trying to express themselves with regard to free speech. It very clearly states that a person commits a crime only if they knowingly damage any property with the intent to damage or hinder agricultural research. And I need to point out that while the terminology says agricultural research, it is defined, agricultural research is also defined to include forestry. So we are talking about any research involving agriculture, animal husbandry, or forestry. This is a very, very serious problem. We ask that you help us put a stop to it, or at least make it extremely costly for those who continue to want to do this. And I may add one point that perhaps would address the question that Senator Harper posed to Representative Shetterly, which was, what would these bills do in terms of some of these current eco-terrorism activities? One of the other facets, which I believe may be caught up in some chasing amendments, is the fact that we had hoped to include, or we did include, and I think it got decoupled because of a relating clause, a section granting treble damages for civil action. What this would allow then, obviously, in the case of, for example, the University of Oregon, if those people were in fact apprehended, excuse me, Oregon State, pardon me, Beavers, if those folks were apprehended, it would allow the university to seek three times the monetary value of the damage that they did, including replacement of the, not only the trees, but any of the research that would be lost as a result of that eco-terrorism activity. So we think it's only appropriate. And as I said, I think one of the major concerns that many of us have, and not just us in the natural resource industry, but in the law enforcement industry, is that we are approaching events of such magnitude that it is invariable that we will start incurring major human injury and death if we don't try to stop this. Any questions?
Terry, I'm not sure if I understood your comment about the decoupling of the treble damages issue, because the AIM Gross bill has that language in it.
Mr. Chair, I think there was an attempt to put treble damage language in all of the bills that Representative Shetterly was mentioning that are part of now in the RICO statute. So I think you are correct that the treble damages are in here for the interference with agricultural research, but there are also amendments that are chasing the tree spiking, the animal interference, and medical research to also make those treble damages for civil action.
All right, and so this amendment applies.
This amendment is okay. You are correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, further questions? Thank you, Terry.
But for the record, I've also submitted testimony from Jean Underhill Wilkinson on behalf of the Farm Bureau. She had to leave early.
She did. Oh, because I was just going to call on it.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody else wanting to testify? House Bill 2385.
This is the streamline hearing. I'd hate to see the big one.
Hi. Hi. You are?
Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, Bart Thielges is my name. I am the Associate Director of the Oregon Forest Research Laboratory and Associate Dean of the College of Forestry at Oregon State University. I'm here to testify on behalf of 2385, and I'm handing out to you the official OSU press release on the incident that happened almost a month ago now, at two locations where we were doing field research on genetically modified organisms, one of which was very difficult to find in the area of Corvallis, the other of which was even more difficult to find out at Klamath Falls. So we expect that whoever did this knew pretty well where our experiments were located. I would just like to say two things, or three things, actually. One is that these kinds of acts of vandalism, which really are very ill-conceived and cause a lot of grief to the people who are working hard to make scientific progress, are very damaging to the morale of the scientific workforce, not only at OSU and the state of Oregon, but everywhere in the world where people are trying to use techniques of genetic transformation to increase the efficiency and, in many cases, the nutrition and the other properties of the world's food supply, and in our case, in forestry, the world's fiber supply. The second thing is that this kind of activity does not take into consideration the simple fact that we wouldn't be doing this if we weren't looking into the safety of it, not just the safety for the people working in the laboratories and the field, but the environmental safety. In fact, Dr. Steve Strauss, the scientist whose field plots were vandalized, is one of the world's foremost activists in the whole area of making sure that we have all of the environmental safety issues checked into before we even begin to release some of these genetically modified organisms. And that comes out in the second handout that I gave, which is a reprint of an article in Science magazine, which is probably one of the two, the other one being the journal Nature, the two most prestigious English language scientific journals in the world. So the incident at Oregon State University out in the boondocks in Corvallis and Klamath Falls is now known all over the world. The third thing that I would like to say, I think was just touched upon by the preceding speaker, and that is, I believe if we don't come up with some kind of a deterrent to these kinds of things, which I think some students and younger people enter into as sort of a lark, I believe that there is going to be some tragic consequences. Unsolicited, on the email, I received an advertisement for somebody who wants to sell me a stun fence to stop these things, and it says that it delivers a very nasty but safe shock. Well, something could easily go wrong with that system, and a nasty shock could turn into a mortal injury. And people will start implementing other measures as well, and it really bothers me that something like this that is aimed at good is going to end up with some kind of tragic consequences. So I hope that you will support 2385 as it goes forward. Thank you. Be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? There are none. Thank you, sir. Report session. House Bill 2385, Ann Gross.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2385, Ann Gross, the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 2385, Ann Gross, the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. Order, Representative, excuse me, Senator Byer, carry that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, I thought he was objecting.
No. Public hearing, House Bill 2344.
Have we already done this one?
Well, to some extent we have, and
motions to send it.
We probably should. Anybody want to, anybody who hasn't spoken on 2344, this is the RICO statute, that would like to speak on it, hasn't already spoken on it. Okay. Work session, House Bill 2344.
Ann Gross to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves. House Bill 2344, Ann Gross to the floor of the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. To order.
I'd like to carry that one too, Mr.
Senator Byer, you may carry that bill also.
Thank you.
Any further discussion before the committee? Senator Duncan? Would you like to vote on these?
I'd like to vote.
Which ones did you miss?
I just missed this one. Mr. Chairman.
Well, you'll be the tie-breaking vote then.
I wouldn't.
How do you vote?
No, I'm not, I don't hear. I'm going to vote aye.
All right. Just to do this really quickly, procedurally, unanimous consent.
Yes, Mr. President, I asked you to suspend the economic vote on the line.
Anybody object to the unanimous consent?
Suspend the rules.
The rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Senator Duncan to vote on House Bill 2344. Hearing no objection.
I vote aye.
Senator Duncan, how do you vote?
We're adjourned. Fine.